Hello and welcome to the new Brother UK Cycling Podcast with me, Timothy John, and my co-host Phil Jones, Managing Director of Brother UK, better known to the cycling community as Road Phil. Phil, good to see you.
Thanks, Tim, and I'm really excited that we've got this podcast together at long last, where we're really going to dive beneath the surface of what's really going on in the UK road cycling scene, bring some of the best riders, the best managers and the best personalities behind the sport, get them in the studio and start telling the stories about why this sport is so great in the UK.
Coming up in the second part of our detailed examination of British domestic road racing, Harry Tanfield explains why even some of the most prestigious UK races are an irrelevance to professional squads searching for exciting new talent.
If it's not got a UCI status attached to it, it's an amateur race. End of. It's a blunt way of looking at it, but fortunately that's how it's seen in Europe.
Sophie Wright, another Brother Cycling graduate, now racing as a paid professional, explains how life at the sport's highest level is no haven of stability.
Sponsors want to see themselves on TV, and so many races, so many women's races aren't televised. When a sponsor sees themselves on TV, they can see the worth. When they can't see themselves, they're quite quick to pull out. You don't get much sense of security, really.
Bex Durrell, the British elite circuit race champion and overall winner of the 2019 National Road Series, explains how domestic success is no guaranteed passport for the sport's top tier.
I'll be completely honest in that, you know, I did put the feelers out for World Tour teams. And, you know, there wasn't really any interest. I find myself in a strange predicament.
Eric Rousell, British Cycling's elite road racing manager, argues that the UK domestic scene needs fewer and better British registered UCI continental teams, and that less can sometimes be more.
I think we need to almost get away in the UK of saying, let's judge ourselves by how many Conti teams we've got. For me, I'd prefer to have one Conti team in the UK, but that one team do things properly and do things correct and support the riders and provide them with a really good race programme, really good support around them, rather than have eight UCI teams which aren't actually that much different to a club team.
Bill Jones, Brother UK's Managing Director and this podcast's co-host, offers an invaluable guide to teams seeking sponsorship in a post-COVID economy.
The trick after 30 years in sales that I've learned is really, really simple. The more personal you make it, the more researched it is, the higher the propensity that you achieve success when you're trying to get sponsorship.
And Matt Hallam, owner and manager of the Brother UK-sponsored Crimson Performance orientation marketing team, describes how engaging with content and making a professional presentation has left his team well-placed to fulfil a long-term ambition.
I always had a dream of taking a team to the Tour of Britain. That was a pipe dream back in 2017 when I first started a race team, but we're getting close to being able to do this. What a story that would be for us to actually achieve that. We'll be going into our fourth year of running the team next year. Five-year plan. Let's throw it out there. Why not go continental? Why not take a team to the Tour of Britain?
Hello and welcome to part two of our in-depth investigation of British domestic road racing. In part one of this episode, we examined the scene from the perspective of race organisers and British Cycling, the domestic sports governing body, and we considered the challenges of organising a race series and staging events. Now it's the turn of the teams and riders to take centre stage. Harry Tanfield's career embodies the instability faced by British riders whose path to the World Tour is not illuminated by the glow of British Cycling's Olympic Academy. His first ascension to the professional ranks came from a Brother UK-sponsored team, but ended a season later when Team Katusha Alpecin sold its licence. Granted a rare second opportunity by Ejidizar Le Mondial, Harry learned in the run-up to his Grand Tour debut at this year's La Vuelta España that the French squad would not seek to retain his services for 2021. Now, shortly after recording the interview that appears in this episode, Harry was offered a route back to the World Tour by Team Assos-Quebeca, having already agreed terms for 2021 with Team Ribble-Weltide, a British-registered UCI Continental squad. Harry's views on the demands and rewards of the British National Road Series compared to UCI-certified events in mainland Europe are worth hearing. Matt Hallam is the young and ambitious manager of the Brother UK-sponsored Crimson Performance orientation marketing team. With a rising budget, expanding team, an exciting new sponsor for 2021, Matt has shown what can be achieved with a professional presentation and high-quality content, even in a year with no racing. Sophie Wright, another former Brother Cycling rider now competing as a professional, describes her route to the top and the tricky business of staying there when teams collapse and COVID narrows your opportunities to race. Soon to begin a 2-year contract with Women's World Tour outfit LABTC Ljubljana, Sophie describes the vital importance of receiving a salary to the business of being a full-time athlete, a benefit simply beyond the budgets of many teams, both men's and women's. Eric Rousel, British Cycling's elite road racing manager, made arguably the most significant contributions to part one of this episode and returns for part two with the kudos of having delivered what he'd promised, a comprehensive calendar of national-level road and circuit racing for 2021. In our latest interview, Eric addresses other issues and initiatives, notably British Cycling's new elite development team status. Bex Durrell is the reigning British circuit race and national road series champion. A dominant campaign with Brother UK Tifosi Power by Onform saw her retained when the team changed its name and status to become the UCI-registered CAMS Tifosi squad. Despite her proven ability and a work ethic that would shame even the most dedicated professional, Bex failed to receive contract offers from teams in the elite UCI Women's World Tour. She shares her theories on why she was overlooked, her appetite for the fresh challenge of racing as a new mum, and her experience of national and international racing. And Phil Jones, my co-host and Brother UK's managing director, offers a vital perspective as leader of the domestic sport's major sponsor and a forensic analysis of the commercial context in which the sport must seek to rebuild from a year without racing and a sustained period of declining investment. Now, just a final reminder before we begin that Brother UK's strict adherence to government guidance on stemming the spread of COVID means that each of our expert witnesses was interviewed remotely. Few riders are more qualified to comment on the rollercoaster existence of a professional cyclist than Harry Tanfield. Harry graduated to the World Tour from a Brother UK-sponsored team in 2019, but when Team Katusha Alpecin sold its license in the same season, Harry found himself seeking alternative employment. Fast forward to the end of the COVID-disrupted 2020 campaign, and Harry found himself again in a similar position. Ajedazar Le Mondial advised him that he would not be retained for 2021 in the weeks leading up to his Grand Tour debut at La Vuelta España. Poor timing from a squad reshaping itself in the image of Classics kingpin Greg Van Avermaet, for whom Tanfield might have been a valued lieutenant.
I did think that too. Obviously, it was a bit of a shock when I heard from them at the end of the year. I mean, I did reach out to them in August and they said they were going to think about it. And they told me in September or whatever, we're not going to renew you. So if it's not, I just want the opportunity to race and to show them Phil, because I've not done that this year to the level of what I wanted to, because I haven't had the racing opportunity. I guess it's like they maybe don't want to take the chance, or they've got more money so they can just go buy someone. Why do they need to pay me minimum wage when they can go and buy someone for 100, 150 grand and who's, you know, maybe going to get top 10 in some classics or come from a better background or something? I don't know. But yeah, it's unfortunate. It's out of my control. So I did kind of plead my case and ask them to let me have the opportunity, but it's not happening.
Since our interview, Harry received an invitation to return to the World Tour with Team Assos Quebeca, an outfit that itself only narrowly avoided exiting professional cycling's top tier, after announcing in September that its partnership with NTT, its previous title sponsor, would soon end. It'll be interesting to note next year how a team forced to compete on the peloton's smallest budget fares against its more moneyed rivals, but Harry and Doug Ryder's squad certainly deserve a place among the best. Like Harry, Sophie Wright graduated to professional cycling's highest echelon from a brother-sponsored team in 2019. Like Harry, her first team no longer exists. Cervélo Bigler became a Keep Paul car and then folded, despite a personal investment by team manager Thomas Campana of €300,000. Unlike Harry, Sophie had already planned her next career move and next season will roll out for a squad officially designated as a UCI Women's World Tour team. Despite this fresh opportunity, Sophie does not underestimate the instability of a career in professional cycling.
I knew I wanted new opportunities, new challenges, new environment, like, and to step up, of course. So yeah, I was delighted to sign a 2-year deal with Allez back in September, I think it was. Fingers crossed that all goes well, but a sponsor, they could easily suddenly crumble, and then that'll literally be it for the whole team. Like, the whole 20, 30, 40 staff and riders within a team will just lose their job. It's not the most secure job to have, not the most secure sport to be in, but it's the risk we take. And I'm just passionate about cycling. I'm in it for the racing. I train to race. It's pretty much my life. And I just think it's worth the risk of, you know, not having the security, because it's what I love.
Despite the insecurity of a career, even at the sport's highest level, the allure of a place on a UCI World Tour team remains undiminished. Rebecca Durrell certainly deserves a seat at cycling's top table, but an opportunity to dine with the elite has not been forthcoming, despite recording overall victory at the 2019 National Road Series and being crowned British Elite Circuit Race Champion. Beck's tale has a happy ending, courtesy of impending motherhood and a contract with Cams Tifosi, the UCI team that last year competed as Brother UK Tifosi, powered by On Form. But her case proves that winning the National Road Series, Rebecca succeeded Sophie Wright as the overall victor in British Cycling's flagship competition, isn't a guaranteed passport to the UCI World Tour.
I'll be completely honest in that, you know, I did put the feelers out for World Tour teams and things like that. And, you know, there wasn't really any interest. I find myself in a bit of a kind of strange predicament sometimes, because I think, well, I performed quite well this year. You know, I'd like to think I would be able to get a spot on a World Tour to a team or whatever, and be able to take that next step up to the races that I really want to succeed in, and to learn from successful riders at that level. But I'll be honest in that I didn't get any opportunities really. So yeah, it's a bit of a strange one. I was obviously really thankful to stay with, well, what now is Cams Tifosi, because in the end we end up doing quite a bit of UCI racing and had a really good time and, you know, had some really great experiences. But yeah, it was a bit of a funny one really. They're not necessarily having to look for domestic riders from the UK who might have potential, unless they're under 23 or they can do well in an under 23 competition, for example, within a race. Motherhood, I guess every mother out there who's been through it, it's such an unknown. And, you know, for me, I'm like, well, as of March, I'm in completely new territory. I'm going to have this little human to look after. And obviously, you've not done it before. And, you know, you just don't know what to expect. And it's such a transition to life that having continuity with a racing team where I know everyone, I know all the girls are on the team, I know how it all works. You know, I can be comfortable in the thought that, you know, once I'm ready and able to come back to racing, and I can just transition back in without the worry and stress of any pressure of, you know, having to get X result or having to be back by a certain date because that's what's in my contract. It definitely makes me feel a lot better, and it makes me look forward to the process of having my baby, but then obviously getting back on track with what I love and the sport I love.
Rebecca's plight offers a window on a wider issue. Just how valuable is the National Road Series to British riders seeking a professional career? We heard in our previous episode from British Cycling's elite road racing manager Eric Rousel that the purpose of the series is to develop riders. So how well does it fulfil this purpose when riders like Rebecca find themselves unable to progress to the professional ranks? Harry Tanfield and Sophie Wright are well placed to comment. Both now hold coveted positions at the highest levels of the sport for men and women. Did the National Road Series provide a valuable education? Did their World Tour employers follow their progress as domestic riders? Are races as cherished by British fans as the Lincoln Grand Prix, valued by teams who seek riders for the Tour of Flanders, for example, or the Strada Bianchi?
If it's not got a UCI status attached to it, it's an amateur race, end of. That's the only way of viewing it in the eyes of someone in Europe. That's literally it. It's a blunt way of looking at it, but unfortunately that's how it's seen in Europe. Can argue the toss all day long, but that's their vision of the race, and that's their vision. Yeah. You could tell them if you'd won Lincoln GP or a local Nat B, and it wouldn't change. If it's non-UCI, it's non-UCI. Simple as that.
I just don't think it compares to World Tour racing, really. And especially with World Tour racing, when you're in a professional team, you properly work as a team. Like when I was on Tirelli Brother, I was just riding as an individual pretty much. So when I stepped up to World Tour, you have to learn to actually ride as a team. I know there are some UK teams that do have proper team tactics and stuff, but it's not as organized and tactical as when you step up to World Tour. And also with World Tour, you've got the radio in your ear as well. You've got the team manager in the car behind giving you instructions, you're feeding back to the team manager, you're talking to the other girls on the team, seeing how they feel. There's pretty much always a strategy, and the difference is everyone else has got a strategy. Like every other team has a strategy. They've spoken about it the night before in the team meeting. It is just that step up, which it took a lot of getting used to for me, because I was used to just racing as an individual, really.
So if the purpose of the National Road Series is to develop British talent to a standard where they can forge careers as professional riders, do the races need to change to become more technical and demanding? Or is it simply a matter of prestige? Can the gap be narrowed by promoting the best domestic races among the sport's most vital constituency, the senior management of the sport's biggest teams? Rebecca Durrell, twice a winner of the Lincoln Grand Prix and a participant in a host of women's World Tour races, including the Tour of Flanders, has an opinion worth hearing. So too does Eric Rousel, British Cycling's elite road racing manager and a former rider who competed in some of the biggest races in the sport, as well as in the British scene's best-loved events.
Lincoln, there's no doubt about it. It's a tough race. It really is. But I just feel that like the Tour of Flanders and some of the big classics over on the continent, that they're just on a different level. I think a lot of it is the strength and depth of the field that you're racing with and just the pure skills you need in the bunch, let alone being able to tackle the actual course itself. You know, if you can't get to the front of that bunch and stay there, then you're never going to win the race, or you're never going to achieve a top 20 result or anything like that. Whereas I think in British races, in some respects, you can almost get away with just being a really strong rider, not necessarily having really fine-tuned bunch skills. So I think that is one of the big differences. And moving kind of between domestic races and big UCI races, I think that is definitely one of the main skills that a lot of people have to crack. Riders have been picked up on World Tour teams just from riding domestic races and not doing much abroad. It is possible, but because the dynamic of the racing abroad is quite different to what we have here in the UK, I do think it can only benefit you to go and race abroad and to start testing yourself against the other teams. That's essentially one of the biggest things. It's the strength and depth of the other riders and the other teams.
Whether it's World Tour or Pro Conti teams, that's ultimately where you want these young British riders or these developing riders to end up, is riding on the world stage, definitely. And World Tour managers, World Tour directors, the first thing they do if they're looking at riders, they've got this fantastic tool online now, Pro Cycling Stats. You go straight on there and look at what riders have done, what races they've competed in, and that won't cover any races lower than UCI 0.2 events. So your Lincoln Grand Prix and those sort of races will never feature on there. In the eyes of a manager, they don't really exist at that level. You know, if you've got a really good agent who knows what he's talking about and pushes that, then that's a bit different. Those races often are harder than a lot of UCI races just because of the way they race and the difference in the fields. Much more aggressive racing, but it's getting that recognition really. And the easiest way to doing that is to try and get those races, or select few of them at UCI level. Because then they will be on the radar, they will be on Pro Cycling Stats and those other websites that managers and teams use to look at, and people will start taking notice of them. That's the thing for me, is trying to get more UCI rake in the UK, which gives those teams that benefit. I think also the thing to note is that British UCI teams, they should be going and racing abroad a lot. They should be competing in a lot of UCI races. I don't think you set up a UCI team just to purely stay in the UK and race. So I think the way I always looked at it on Madison, I had my big targets were the Tour of Yorkshire, Ride London when it wasn't World Tour, and the Tour of Britain. We then also had our races abroad, which were big events, which were the Tour of Normandy and the other races you ride in Belgium, Holland and France. The National Series was sort of sandwiched in between to fill the gaps. So if a team is using the National Series as their real pinnacle, I think UCI teams should be looking beyond that really, and looking at the international races.
Eric and Rebecca make valid points. Rebecca's observations on the greater technical demands of the Women's World Tour echo those of Sophie Wright, but she is optimistic about the future of domestic road racing, as we'll hear later in this episode. Meanwhile, Eric's aim to encourage UCI status for more of the best British races will hearten many. His observation on the value of an informed agent to overcome reliance on Pro Cycling Stats is accurate too. In fact, both Eric and Harry are right when they say that UCI status is everything for a professional team. But if so few British races have that status, should British Cycling support its administrative efforts by bringing those they hope will grant opportunities to British riders to watch those races in which they learn their trade? And is there value in inviting lower-tier squads from mainland Europe to compete? Phil Jones believes so. Major businesses like Brother UK understand the value of personal experience to support wider communication initiatives.
Advocacy is needed always, wherever you are and whatever you do. And maybe if you look back perhaps at what happened with the Tour de Yorkshire, Sir Gary Verity was very involved in advocacy for Yorkshire, wasn't he? He was one of the people that sort of behind the scenes had done a lot of the cajoling to actually bring, you know, this sort of high quality UCI race to Yorkshire and then to see it grow from there. So advocacy, I think, does play a part. I accept what Harry says, he's absolutely right. Unless it's a 1.2 or, you know, it has some sort of UCI ranking, then the World Tour teams, a lot of the Pro Conti teams are not interested to come. So the issue there is then, well, actually, there's lots of races that our domestic teams go over to Belgium to race, which aren't UCI races. So it doesn't always mean that a UCI badge is the only thing that's going to mean teams from overseas. And I'm not just talking about World Tour teams here. I'm talking about all manner of teams might actually see that the domestic scene is also a very good place for their riders on the continent to come and experience a different style of racing, as domestic riders do when they go over to Belgium and race there. So I don't think it's all about getting World Tour teams here. We know that's only going to happen when there's UCI ranking, full stop, and when there's a sort of a financial reason for them to come. If there isn't that, then they're not coming. Really simple. But beneath that, I think there's definitely an opportunity to see, is there a way where we could just get greater levels of participation from teams overseas on the continent just to come and experience British racing as part of the development of their own riders, then I think there's probably a great role for advocacy there.
The value of the domestic road scene as a breeding ground for talent able to compete in the professional ranks seems open to debate. Harry believes that some UK races are harder than UCI certified equivalents in Europe, while both Sophie and Bex identify a significant gap between the tactical demands of World Tour and domestic racing. What isn't open to debate, however, is that a place in the men's UCI World Tour comes with a guaranteed salary, and in the women's World Tour, the majority are paid too. With this in mind, the ability of the National Road Series to develop riders for professional careers takes on an added significance. Nobody wants to race for free, and if they're training and racing to a professional standard, nor should they. Let's hear from Sophie on how a salary helps her to perform as an elite athlete, and from Harry on the fundamental importance even of a minimum wage.
I am fortunate enough to be paid. I am living the dream. I'm being paid to do my hobby. Don't get me wrong, it's hard work, but I'm getting paid to do what I love. If I wasn't getting paid, yeah, obviously I'd have to get a part-time job. That probably wouldn't pay that much with it being part-time. You know, I'd have to keep living at home for longer. It would just be made very awkward. I mean, when it comes to booking your flights, booking your hotels and stuff, it really adds up. Even fuel, all these little things add up. On a part-time job, it's very hard to do. Also, it'd be very hard to get to the top and stay at the top if you're not full-time committing to your sport. Yes, you can wake up at 7 a.m, do a 2 or 3 hour training ride, then go to work. Yeah, you've got that 3 hour ride in, but then you're spending the rest of the day working when actually you could be recovering at home, getting correct nutrition, whereas instead you're sat at a desk or you're on your feet stacking shelves or whatever the job is and not focusing on recovery. You can do all the training in the world, but if you don't get the correct recovery in, that training's just useless because you're not adapting from it.
It does bring another aspect into it of just stress and what you're doing with your time, and ultimately you do need money to live on. It's minimum wage, but it's still a decent living income to go from that to nothing. It's no longer a job, it then becomes a hobby.
Harry's argument is surely valid. The minimum wage in the UCI World Tour for men is €40,045 a year. The sports world governing body introduced a minimum wage for the UCI Women's World Tour this year of €15,000, rising to €20,000 next year and €27,500 in 2022. By 2023, the UCI wants minimum wage parity between the men's and women's professional pelotons. So should the British domestic road scene have a minimum wage too? Few would object to such an admirable aspiration, but the reality of a sport funded almost entirely by private companies, who themselves are facing a significant economic downturn, means that such an ambition would be difficult to realise, as Phil Jones explains.
You can't just say all of a sudden we, for 2021, are going to insist that there is now a minimum wage involved in the sport, because probably half the teams that are out there racing today aren't going to exist because they don't actually have the sponsorship income that they're actually receiving. It's probably just enough for them to actually exist, i.e. get to races, get their kit, cover the travel, hotels, the odd meal now and again, some sort of low-level expenses, race entry fees, and that's about it. There isn't a lot left in the at the end of the day. So you go, well, okay, well, what's the problem you're trying to solve? We need more income. And we're back to this question again, Tim, aren't we? Of, well, how do we now get more income? Well, in order to get that income and to start paying people and for them to have salaries at a minimum wage and all this sort of stuff, then reality, even if you were looking at saying, I want to be a full-time rider, you're looking at a payment probably of 20,000 or more a year at minimum wage to be paying somebody for X many hours per week to ride their bike. So suddenly when you look at a squad and you put 10 riders on that squad, or 12 riders or 14 riders, you're already at 300,000-ish a year. That's before you do anything. That's in terms of your salary bill. If you then look at all the other stuff, most teams who, let's say, are not UCI teams are probably getting by on 30, 40,000 a year potentially, just to sort of cover their costs. So you're looking at needing to raise 350,000 or more per year. And the environment we have in the UK is just simply not there for people to be writing sponsorship deals of that size for this sport. I would love to see everybody back to where things were, earning money, being a full-time bike rider, a full-time mechanic, a full-time team manager. My goodness, we'd see the sport really thrive. But the commercial realities and the economic realities of where we are, even at this particular moment in time, mean that it's probably the right decision at the wrong time.
The recent era of six British registered UCI continental teams, well funded and well run, taking the fight to the heavyweights of the UCI World Tour and winning in races like the Tour of Britain, the Tour de Yorkshire and the Tour de Normandy, already seems like a distant age. So how does the British domestic scene regroup? If Phil's analysis that the same economic conditions simply don't exist is correct, and as the leader of a major business, it seems safe to assume that it is, then what is the answer? For Eric Rousell, domestic road racing needs to face the new reality. The means and metrics by which the scene previously measured its health no longer apply, he argues.
I think we need to almost get away in the UK of saying, well, let's judge ourselves by how many Conti teams we've got. For me, I'd prefer to have one Conti team in the UK, but that one team do things properly and do things correct and support the riders and provide them with really good race program, really good support around them, rather than have eight UCI teams which aren't actually that much different to a club team. And I think that's what we need to get away from, judging it by, well, how many Conti teams have we got? Because if we've got more, then it's brilliant. Actually, we might have less, but they're really well run, really well supported. That's, for me, is more important than just having loads and loads of teams. And I think that's hopefully where sort of the elite teams can come in. If people can see value for riding for an elite team, then that makes them more attractive than everyone saying, well, we've got to be a Conti team, we've got to be a Conti team. And really, there's not an awful lot of difference other than they get to ride the Tour of Britain, which is obviously a huge thing. But in my opinion, you shouldn't set up a Conti team just to ride the Tour of Britain. You're doing it for very wrong reasons if that's why you're doing it. So hopefully that's where sort of the elite teams will come into its own, that we can build on them and progress that, and that'll become more attractive.
We'll hear more about British cycling's elite development team status later in this episode. For now, it's fair to say that domestic teams of any level or standard are facing an unprecedented challenge after a year without racing. Matt Hallam, owner and manager of the Brother UK-sponsored Crimson Performance Orientation marketing outfit, has delivered another year of economic growth for his team, despite such exceptional circumstances. But even he admits the times are tough.
It's fight or flight, really, for race teams right now. You either be dynamic and adapt to this new normal, find ways to provide return to your sponsors to make them back your vision going forward into this next year, when, let's face it, we still really don't know the full extent to what actually might be on offer next year. You've got to look at it in two ways, basically. You can either retract and become very negative and pessimistic, and fundamentally, that's not how I am as a person. I'm a positive person. I keep a positive outlook on things, even when things aren't going as well as you hoped. And that's the path I decided to take with this. And that's what I've stuck to since the outset. And I'm pleased to say that you will be going into 2021 in an even stronger position. And I want to go into 2021 in a stronger position than I was heading into this year. And I've achieved that.
We'll hear more from Matt in this episode on his proven ability to win sponsors and how his grasp of content and presentation has delivered year-on-year growth for his team. Matt's unswerving analysis of the position teams find themselves in, what he describes as fight or flight, speaks volumes for the effect of a year without racing. But his determination to remain positive and the commercial results his outlook has delivered is of equal interest. For those prepared to embrace it, a more positive future lies ahead, COVID permitting. Since our last episode, British Cycling has published the National Road Series and Elite Circuit Series calendars for 2021. The leader of the domestic sport's major commercial partner, does this provide Phil, in his role as Managing Director of Brother UK, with a sense of optimism?
Yes, indeed it does. And I'm super happy that at least this has been published well before the season has started. Obviously, what we've heard and seen published from BC now is 8 rounds for the National Road Series for men, 8 rounds for the Women's National Road Series. And then, of course, in the Circuit Series, 5 rounds for the men and 3 rounds for women. So that's really good because at least we now know that there is something to look forward to. I think it gives something for sponsors to feel comfort that there's a road series going to take place, and it gives the riders something to train for. And of course, it now gives teams and their respective owners and director sportives an ability, if they are trying to land a sponsor for, you know, in the final hours, at least they can throw this in front of somebody and now and say, look, here is a race series. So assuming that the COVID crisis is clearing up, the vaccine success is working, then crossing fingers, we've got some racing to look forward to in 2021.
This episode is moving quickly and taking us further from our starting point, the challenges faced by British riders in the domestic scene in the UCI World Tour, and the suitability of the former as a training ground for the latter. Before we move further into the territory of teams, their battle for sponsorship in a post-COVID economy, the value of content and marketing in a social media age, and much more besides, let's conclude this opening section from a rider's perspective. Still only 26, Harry Tanfield has accumulated experiences in races as diverse as the Chorley Grand Prix and La Vuelta España. How does he compare the domestic and World Tour scenes?
Certainly a lot of races in the UK that are just amateur races are the level of a 1.2 in Europe, but they don't have the status. I would even say that some races are harder. I've raced in Europe doing 1.2s, and I've done two of the Res Chorley Grand Prix and some strong UK Conti teams all fighting it out. And the level in the UK is significantly higher than what it was in some of the 1.2s I've done in Holland and Belgium and stuff like that. Harder races, I thought personally, the ones in the UK, but they don't have a UCI status. So on paper, you know, they don't have the merit of the UCI race, but I found them harder.
Having considered the plight of riders, working hard to make a living from cycling in a domestic scene hit by COVID and declining investment, and instability even at World Tour level, let's turn our attention to teams. In our last episode, Phil accurately described their total dependence on sponsorship as a boom and bust model. With a new season fast approaching, has he noticed any evidence of a changed approach?
In any sport, in any business, businesses start and businesses fail. And in the sport of cycling, teams will start and teams will fail and end. So this is just sort of the natural rhythm of life. But I think in the longer term, you know, if I'm looking at the domestic sport right now and saying, right, have we seen any systemic shift in the way that the business model works, either in the teams or the governing body or anything around the model events, then I would have to say, no, I haven't. I haven't seen any sort of big stick shifts during 2020, which is going to sort of change the fabric of the sport for 2021 and beyond. So unfortunately, the problem still exists at a structural level about the way the sport works. And whether or not that's ever going to change itself, well, we'll see.
The issue of road racing's funding model is at once simple and complex. The simplicity lies in identifying the missing revenue source. But simply, race organisers can't charge spectators to watch from the roadside. Further, the handful who generate an income from selling televised coverage, vast conglomerates like Tour de France owners ASO, don't share broadcast revenues with the teams. Complexity lies in identifying revenue streams to replace the gate receipts and television revenues of sports like football, rugby and cricket. The challenge is difficult to overcome, but not impossible. In episode 5, Phil identified the game-changing revenue opportunity offered to teams by the new discipline of e-racing. with many of his insights validated by the recent hosting of cycling's first eSports World Championships, it seems only sensible to ask what further opportunities he identifies.
It's the question I think that everybody wants answering, isn't it? What is the silver bullet that's going to turn a team around or turn the sport around? I think what we're looking at here is, how is there a better way whereby a team with some certainty can know that it has incomes beyond the season that it's in? More than a one-year contract, 2 years, 3 years, 4 years and 5 years. And again, if you look through other sports, for example, the Premier League, that they have a responsibility to sort of send some money down, send the elevator back down to some of the smaller teams. And you look at the money around the World Tour and you might look at that and say, is there a percentage that ought to be perhaps scooped off towards a development pathway? So that's one thing. If you look about riders and how they're moving out of the domestic scene up until the World Tour, there isn't any, unlike some other professional sports, a sort of a drag and tag payment that says, well, actually, they started here. So if they get there and become super successful, then what we're expecting is that sort of some money flows back to recognise where the development started. So that could be at an individual rider level.
Funding from the UCI World Tour, distributed by the governing body for teams lower down professional cycling's pyramid, sounds like a sensible solution. If Team Ineos, for example, isn't minded to create a British-registered UCI Continental squad to serve as an incubator, a sliver of its £40 million annual operating budget, shared from a collective pot by the UCI, would do much to resolve the annual funding crisis of smaller teams. Similarly, Phil's suggestion of a transfer fee represents another mechanism by which the sport's wealth could be redistributed. What other means might be available? Staying with football, the biggest clubs do an effective job of monetizing the passion of their fans. And let's not overlook the governing body. British Cycling generates substantial revenues in membership fees. Could some of this income be channeled to support grassroots teams? Phil believes so.
I still don't think, in my view, enough is done by teams to bring their fans into the funding model. So to say, ultimately, be part of the team, be part of our future, create a sort of a model whereby a fan can actually give to a team and give directly to a team, knowing that they, as a fan of the sport, are helping to actually fund that team for the longer term. And then, of course, you've got the Federation. And of course, the Federation collects annual subscriptions from British Cycling members and through other funding sources. You could also look at that and say, does the Federation have any role within this to actually try and have some money that they accrue in their annual incomes to flow back directly to the development of the sport and the sustainability of the teams participating in the sport?
While teams come and go from every level of the sport with alarming regularity, some get it right year after year. Increasingly, those able to stay the course do so with an engaging presentation, able to generate return on investment for sponsors, almost regardless of results. In the men's UCI World Tour, Team EF Education First are a fine example. The team with arguably the strongest identity in the Women's World Tour is Canyon-SRAM. While both are regular race winners, boasting rosters filled with formidable riding talent, neither of them could be described as dominant. Matt Hallam, owner and manager of the Brother UK-sponsored Crimson Performance Orientation marketing team, might have been taking notes. A young manager in a hurry, next year his team will begin its fourth season by again increasing its budget and expanding its squad. It's no coincidence that Matt's team does a fine job with content, providing sponsors like Brother UK with a regular supply of high-quality films and images in which logo placement is prominent. The same strategy has attracted a new sponsor for 2021, one of a scale and kudos that Matt believes will change the game for his team.
In my opinion, the biggest thing that has allowed the team to grow at the rate it has done is the image that we've achieved. You know, I can confidently say going into 2021, we'll be turning heads next year with what we're going to be doing. We've got an absolutely massive deal in place. I'm just amazed that I've actually been able to pull this off. I can't believe it. But a brand like the sponsor that we've signed a deal with, they would just never, ever approach someone like us if they didn't think we were on image. And all the work we've done through the social media, through outreach opportunities, through news channels online, sponsors themselves. You know, Brother UK is providing us with a lot of outreach opportunities as well. And utilizing every one of those and producing really good content that's professional, that's what's got us to this position now. Because I can show sponsors my portfolio of content, and I can guarantee you that's on par with the Continental team, if not better. I can provide them an opportunity to come into this for not a lot of money. I can get these deals signed quickly because people want to be involved in our project. You know, we look cool. We look good on bikes. I've got a great group of riders that are approachable. We provide sponsors with continuous content, and that's what's really set us onto the trajectory that we're on at the moment.
Satisfying sponsors with high-quality content that celebrates the partnership of team and corporate backer is clearly a critical consideration, and especially in a year with no racing. With no events to report, no victories to celebrate or results to analyse, the ability to fill social media channels and corporate brochures with images of honed athletes living the values of sporting excellence takes on an added importance. The values piece is significant. For Bex Durrell, a personable and intelligent ambassador for her team, its sponsors and her sport, a sponsor's association with the values of sport is almost as important as brand exposure. Logo placement is only one benefit she maintains with which cycling can repay its backers. She argues for embedding values inside an event, much as Belgium's Kermesse races typically form the centrepiece of town festivals that represent a wider celebration, a community and civic pride.
I know over on the continent, a lot of races are based around like families and having bears there and getting everybody involved in the race. It's not necessarily only about the bike race itself. It's about everything else that goes with it. And I think this can translate over to the whole point of sponsorship for teams as well. And when you've got a sporting team, especially on a domestic level, it isn't necessarily all about, right, getting a sponsor's logo out there. That is very, very important. But I think a lot of it is about the ethos of the team and basically what people gain from the team, what supporters gain from the team. And, you know, with that, it's all of the values of sport. It's why we do it. It's teamwork, it's dedication, it's discipline. You know, you're trying to change yourself for the better, and that gives other people enthusiasm to do the same for themselves. And I don't know how it's possible, but if that can somehow be strengthened and bolstered within our sport at the domestic level, and if that becomes one of the key aims of the race is to try and kind of boost those feelings and those values by having it as part of a bigger event, then I think it will only go from strength to strength.
So how important are the values of a sport to a corporate backer? Few are more qualified to answer than my co-host, Phil Jones, Brother UK's Managing Director. A major business in the United Kingdom and part of a corporation of truly global scale, values are a critical consideration both internally and externally for Brother and for Phil. Sponsorship investments send a signal to the outside world, but offer an internal message of equal importance, a sign, in the case of cycling, that physical health, mental well-being, active travel, and dedication to personal growth are shared values. Comes as little surprise, then, that Phil, an authoritative voice on leadership and corporate cultures, is keenly aware of cycle sport's proposition, and shares Rebecca's belief in its importance to securing long-term sustainability for teams and events.
I think Bex is making a really, really important point here. When we're thinking about where we're putting our overall investment, ultimately, what it really is about is creating the platforms for people to improve their potential. It allows somebody, whether we're sponsoring a team or a race or providing the neutral service, to train for something, aspire for something, and to be something that they previously might not have been. So we very much see that. And why we've done a lot of our grassroots investing is because the sheer sort of joy that we get of seeing people who are improving, growing themselves. And part of our strapline behind the scenes is to grow ourselves through growing others. Now that, from a professional perspective, means we want to grow our channel partners and our business partners to become better businesses and to grow through our business partnership or the products that they sell. But if we take that and we lift it up and we put that into, well, why are we into domestic cycling? Then you can also say that we're trying to do exactly the same thing in order to amplify that ultimate position statement.
Phil's strong grasp of sponsorship in its many forms is literally part of the job for the leader of a major business. Increasingly, however, it's a major concern for teams and riders too. Anyone competing at any level of a sport dependent on brand exposure for income needs to understand and appreciate the mechanics of content and marketing, and almost every member of the Brother Cycling family seems to do so. For Sophie Wright, forging her way in a branch of the sport desperate for exposure, and Matt Hallam, seeking to satisfy sponsors with a blend of positive association and reach, television remains an important part of the jigsaw. What television means as we approach the third decade of the second millennium, however, is open to debate. British Cycling caused consternation among teams earlier this year when it announced that it would no longer fund coverage on Eurosport, but Eric Rousel maintains the Federation is committed to exploring other avenues. Let's hear now from Sophie, Matt and Eric.
Sponsors want to see themselves on TV. They want to be getting their name out there. And so many races aren't televised. So many women's races aren't televised. When a sponsor sees themselves on TV, they can see the worth. They can see that their money and support is actually worth it. Whereas when they can't see themselves on TV and when the sponsor's logo isn't being shown, they're quite quick to pull out. You don't get much sense of security, really.
You know, from a sponsor's perspective, putting money into a race team, visibility is a key return that they're looking for, and television outreach provides that. So when that's taken away, it's difficult to really fill that gap. You've got to try and find other ways to fill that huge hole that's been left from your sponsorship proposal.
It wasn't value for money at all, having it on Eurosport at 11 o'clock at night, 2 weeks after the race had already happened. And anyone that said there was massive value in that, I would seriously question it. But is there value in a live stream? We did do that for the Circuit Series last year. There wasn't a huge following, I wouldn't have said, on that. I think it was okay. But again, for the money it cost to do a live stream, was there actually that return for it? I don't know. I'm not in that area of expertise to know if it was or not. It's certainly not something which has been put to bed and just forgotten about. It's still ongoing, looking at different ways to do it, both organisers individually themselves and us as a governing body.
Talk of television leads us back to the vital nature of sponsorship. A cycling team with aspirations for national success simply can't survive without it. Matt Hallam is not the only manager in the Brother Cycling family with an enviable record for retaining sponsors. Team Brother UK on-form Simon Howes can make a similar boast. But the speed with which Matt has grown his team and its commercial support is impressive. He doesn't offer his success as the template and maintains that each team must find its own way. But there must be aspects of his approach from which others can learn.
I've been very fortunate in the sense I've kept a lot of my founding sponsors from when we started the team back in 2018. I've kept over 90% of my sponsors that put financial investment into the team. I've already got 3 years of developing relationships with each of those. So it then becomes a lot easier for them to buy into the vision of what you're trying to achieve with the team. They can see the progression year on year. They can see how the team is progressing as well, how it looks on social media, how it looks on marketing campaigns. That does equate to a lot as well. Like I said, it's going to be different for everyone that has a team and that is lucky enough to be in a position to pursue running a race team. But that's the way I did it, so I can't really speak for anyone else. I was fortunate in that sense that I had contacts in place through my job of being a bike fitter. I was meeting lots of different people and I was able to utilize those contacts to actually get enough sponsorship to get the team off the ground. I built on that year on year. I've been lucky enough to bring in additional resource, new sponsors. It still equates to a lot of money for these businesses that are backing us, but it's not significant amounts of money. We can provide a lot of return for that now.
Matt's final sentence is the most revealing. He is focused on what his team can provide for its sponsors and not the other way around. The distinction is critical, according to Phil, and he of all people should know. As well as planning Brother UK's strategic development and managing a plethora of day-to-day issues, Phil plays a vital role in managing the company's sponsorship portfolio, a comprehensive series of investments in organisations as diverse as the Halle Orchestra and the Tour of Britain. Armed with 30 years' experience in sales, including as Brother UK's sales director before becoming leader of the business, it's fair to say that Phil knows more than a little about writing an effective proposal.
Tim, I could write a book on this one because I receive so many sponsorship proposals, and I don't just mean from cycling teams. It's been very busy in the last few weeks, to be fair, with you know, people knocking on the door. But I mean, from all sports, cultural organisations, events, all sorts of things, we are constantly approached and asked for financial support of one kind or the other. I was discussing this with somebody the other day who'd asked my advice on it, and I'd recently done a talk on this issue. I guess if I was to take the last 100 proposals that I've seen and say, well, which one worked and actually got some airtime, and why did the 99 others not get airtime? It's primarily because the 99 others were poorly researched, very vanilla, and they didn't think about what brother might benefit from the partnership.
Teams who focus proposals on themselves rather than the sponsor reveal a fundamental misunderstanding of the nature of the relationship. Worse, they shine a spotlight on the generic nature of their offer. Think about it. Almost every team that approaches Brother UK competes in the same races and has a broadly similar list of benefits. Logo placement on the jersey, logo placement on the car, and a social media following of greater or lesser significance. The net effect is the vanilla sensation that Phil describes. His advice is simple. Do your research, identify how sponsoring your team will help their business, and above all, make it personal. Those who don't must prepare to pay the wee fee.
So the trick after 30 years in sales that I've learned is really, really simple. The more personal you make it, the more researched it is, the higher the propensity that you will achieve success in what it is you're trying to do when you're trying to gain sponsorship or to ask somebody for some sort of paid partnership. And it really comes down to that. So the people that are most successful and the people where we've thought, oh, that's interesting, have tended to be highly personalised approaches where something comes in and you look at it and you say, now that is not a blanket proposal. That has been something that's been prepared for us. We can see the value in it. I have a little one-liner that I say that effectively says, you will pay the wee fee. If all you do is talk about you, we, the fee you're going to pay is we're not going to listen to you. So you will pay the we fee if you don't personalise your proposals. And if you use the word we far too much in your inbound communication, we're this, we're the other, we this, rather than you. So have a look at what it is you're preparing. Have a look at the process that you're undertaking and make it all about the person that you're approaching.
It's natural that private businesses ask what value a sponsorship agreement holds for them. As the uncompromising realities of a post-COVID and post-Brexit economy grow, their search for value is likely to grow ever more intense. So how can British Cycling support teams in their bid for survival? It's in the Federation's interest, of course, to have actors in the drama of their National Road Series. Eric Rousel believes the Federation's new elite development team status will add validity to those teams that operate to the highest standards.
The status of the proposal we're putting in place for elite development teams is for senior teams, so focusing on sort of under 23, under 27 riders, really. It's trying to introduce a rebirth of the old elite national team status, which was brought in, I think, 2014 or 15, and sort of recent years has fizzled out a bit. So it's trying to rebirth that, but obviously doing it for men's and for women's teams this time, rather than just men's teams. So it's very much focused on those teams that sit just below UCI teams. They're still technically registered as clubs with British Cycling. They're not UCI teams. They are more than clubs, they are teams, but there's not actually anything that recognises them as teams. So it's trying to create something for them which gives them sort of a status and a focus and helps sort of build their backing and their credibility as well, as saying, well, these are the teams that are riding all the national series, providing a platform for their riders, getting international race entries. They're not UCI teams, but they are doing all the right things to try and provide the riders with that stepping stone to step on and step up to UCI teams. It's very much trying to give them that status that they can then use and say to sponsors, look, we are an elite development team, we're highly regarded by British Cycling. What we want to do is we want to create a page on the British Cycling website which is dedicated to these teams, so anyone that is talking to sponsors or even race organisers, they've got somewhere to direct them, and they can go onto the governing body's website that has just a small plug about the team and some links out to the team's social media and website, a little sort of feature on the team. We'll then do some regular sort of social digital stuff throughout the season with the team as well to keep on top of all that sort of thing. Some teams are really good at it already. Some teams are already fantastic at their social and digital side. Some teams might need a bit more support. For some teams, it will be a huge benefit for them. I spoke to some managers who said when they go out and try and get invites to UCI races and they're not a UCI team, so they just come come as a club team, but if they can actually go and say, well, look, we're recognised by British Cycling as, you know, one of these elite development teams, it just holds a little bit more status for them, and it may work, it may not. It's certainly not going to do any harm for teams to have that status and that recognition from us, and to go out to sponsors and say, well, look, you know, we're here on the website, we're recognised, one of the better teams. We're also trying to create some assets for teams to use, so get some logos designed, that a bit like they have for the UCI Europe Tour, where all the teams have the little logo on their jersey. We're not going to say all teams have to have on their jersey, but just give them some assets, some digital assets like that as well, that they can use when they're putting sponsors packs together and stuff like that. It's all about trying to recognise these teams that are doing things in the right way, supporting the riders, providing riders with that platform, and then us as the governing body trying to support them in doing that and offer them that backing from us as well to do what they're doing.
The elite development team status and Eric's longer-term ambition to introduce a tiered structure to national domestic road racing represent real change after years of decline. Eric believes that teams like Cycling Sheffield represent a vital stepping stone between clubs and UCI continental teams, and he cites Connor Swift's progression to the UCI World Tour by Madison Genesis as evidence for what elite development team status might achieve.
Cycling Sheffield is a fantastic example, and what they did with Connor Swift. He rode for Cycling Sheffield, developed really well as a rider there, moved on to Madison, and then jumped up now to riding the Tour de France this year. That's one complete example there of where that pathway would work, that a rider can go onto one of those elite teams, develop from that to a Conti team. There wasn't necessarily any connections between Cycling Sheffield and Madison Genesis, but Cycling Sheffield certainly gave him that pathway to develop onto that team, which then gave him the pathway to develop up to a Tour de France rider. So that's the sort of the pathway that we see in what we're trying to develop.
What value might it hold for a team like Brother UK's sponsored Crimson Performance Orientation Marketing? A squad that already excels in its presentation and with ambitions beyond elite status. Matt Hallam says he needs more details, but gains confidence from Eric's experience in domestic road racing and remains cautiously optimistic.
So I can see the theory and the principles behind why they're doing this tiered approach and, you know, introducing this now elite development team status. And it's nice to see ideas being implemented. It's great to see that after years of being almost in a stagnating position where ideas would be introduced but nothing would ever happen. It's great to see things actually be in action now, and change is, in my opinion, is a good thing. It needs change. We're getting that change, and we've got someone that is driving this that has been involved in domestic cycling in the UK for a long time. They know how things should work. I can only see that as being a positive, really. I need to understand things a little bit better after speaking to Eric, but from what I can see right now, I think it's a big step forward for us.
Matt is not alone in extending a cautious welcome to Eric's initiatives. We heard from race organiser Peter Harrison in part one of this episode how Eric had won the hearts and minds of the National Organisers Group. The subsequent publication of Eric's National Road Series and Elite Circuit Series calendars for men and women in 2021 have been well received, and not least by Phil Jones, who cites the confidence sponsors gain from seeing such tangible milestones drawn on the roadmap to sponsorship activation. But what does Phil make of the elite development team status? Will it reveal the underlying ambition of a team, whether it's focused on encouraging participation or growing into a more performance-focused outfit? And, critically, can it be regarded as a substitute for UCI continental status, coveted by domestic teams as the minimum entry requirement for the Tour of Britain and its guaranteed 7 days of national television exposure? Here's Phil.
Another tricky issue, Tim, for sure. What we're actually saying is there's quite an expensive ticket price to pay to get yourself on the list of people that might be able to get one of those places of qualification into the Tour of Britain. But the ticket price you've got to pay to even be on that list is obviously you've got to have your UCI registration, which takes money. I think what you've got to ask yourself is actually, well, what is your aspiration? Where are you trying to sit in the hierarchy of the sport? Because ultimately, if you're quite happy to be just an elite development team, and you're in this because what you actually want is to see riders develop, do well, begin to race in the sport, fill the sport up with a lot of active participants, then actually this will probably be unimportant to you to sort of have that UCI status. If you've got loftier ambitions to try and head up the ranks and ultimately become a world tour team one day, or if you've got a much bigger overhead cost, rider salary bill, etc., etc., then part of the model simply is that we're going for this. We want to be a team with a budget of 300, 400, 500,000. The only way we're going to get is we have to be in the Tour of Britain. We have got to race the season like we've got to qualify. So every race is, you know, all about qualification. And therefore, we've hung our hat with potential sponsors on that ambition. So it's a really quite high risk strategy where it's sort of Monte Carlo or bust, really, Tim, isn't it? You know, we're looking to achieve this, but there actually isn't a guarantee you're going to achieve it, because still, obviously, Tour of Britain is a qualification process. But it could well be that as we end the year this year that and begin into 2021, that might be automatic qualification based upon the number of continental teams that we may actually have in the UK. So I think to some degree, you know, Eric's got a point here. Is it about having loads and loads of teams that are living from hand to mouth, all trying to squeeze in for this Tour of Britain qualification? That might not actually be the model which will make the sport sustainable for the long term.
Is the domestic road scene approaching a turning point? Eric Rousell's priorities as elite road racing manager and drastically changed economic conditions from a moneyed heyday in which the sport bathed in the reflected glow of home Olympic success and a first British Tour de France winner seem to be shifting the scene's emphasis from the achievements of a privately funded few to raise standards among a broader constituency. Whether this more accurately reflects the proper purpose of a domestic scene or the wider economic realities of a sport that leaves riders even as talented as Harry Tanfield falling in and out of the UCI World Tour is an interesting topic for debate. If applying the gloss of professional marketing to the National Road Series would give it a sheen to match the Olympic Academy's golden achievements, would riders like Rebecca Durrell be struggling to convince World Tour teams of her talent? Or should the Federation's first priority for its National Series always be to provide a first opportunity? The fact remains that within recent memory, the scene supported 6 British-registered UCI Continental teams with full-time and salaried staff and riders, and that, in 2012, one of them won the Tour of Britain. However tarnished the individual result, Enduro Racing's performance as a team that year cannot be questioned, as Eric, of all people, will know. Are participation and performance necessarily exclusive? One team accelerating rapidly from a standing start is Brother UK-sponsored Crimson Performance Orientation Marketing, a team founded to grant opportunities to riders in the Northwest, but which has proved that professional presentation becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. Team owner and manager Matt Hallam has demonstrated the keenest understanding of the undeniable value of content and marketing from day one, and has reaped the benefits year on year in the shape of increased budgets and expanded squads. While rivals retrench their positions or conclude their operations entirely, Matt's men and women prepare to don a new iteration of their sleek crimson kit, replete with the names of founding sponsors like Brother UK, and several new names besides, one of them, arguably, the biggest in the sport. Let's leave the final word, then, to Matt.
I always had a dream of taking a team to the Tour of Britain. That was a pipe dream back in 2017 when I first started a race team, but we're getting close to being able to do this. What a story that would be for us to actually achieve that. We'll be going into our 4th year of running the team next year. 5-year plan. Let's throw it out there. Why not go continental? Why not take a team to the Tour of Britain?
We'll conclude this episode in our normal manner with a social shout-out. If you'd like to follow any of our expert witnesses on social media, you can do so at the following addresses. Phil Jones posts about cycling from @RoadPhil on Twitter and Instagram. You can follow Phil's tweets on business and leadership @PhilJones40. You can find Harry Tanfield on Facebook and Instagram @HarryTanfield.94 and on Twitter @HarryTanfield94. Note the absence of a full stop between Tanfield and 94 in the Twitter handle. Rebecca Durrell is on Twitter @BexDurrell and on Instagram @Bex_Durrell. Eric Rousell is on Twitter and Instagram @EricRousell. You can follow Sophie Wright on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram @SophieKWright. number 8. You can follow Matt Hallam on Twitter at @Matt_Hallam and on Instagram at @BikeFitMCR. You can follow the Brother UK-sponsored Crimson Performance Orientation Marketing Team on Facebook at We Are Crimson Cycling, or one word, on Twitter at Crimson Cycling, and on Instagram at Crimson Performance. And we sincerely hope you'll follow Brother Cycling. We're at Brother Cycling on all three channels. Thanks very much indeed for listening, and stay safe.
If you've enjoyed today's episode, please hit subscribe.